The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
Back in Studio North. Good September the 21st to you. The lead story remains Vladimir Putin's threat to use nuclear weapons in Ukraine. Roger Cohen, longtime correspondent and columnist for the New York Times, writes on the landing page of the New York Times this morning, a cornered Vladimir Putin is more dangerous than ever. Vladimir Putin's menacing televised address on Tuesday, Mr. Cohen writes, was much more than a bid to change the course of his faltering war against Ukraine. It attempted to invert a war of aggression against a neighbor into one of defense of a threatened motherland, a theme that resonates with Russians steeped in patriotic history. Mr. Putin, Russia's president, aimed at nothing less than altering the meaning of the war for his country, raising the stakes for the entire world. He warned the West in unmistakable terms, quote, this is not a bluff, that the attempt to weaken or defeat Russia could provoke a nuclear cataclysm. Now, later in the article, Mr. Cohen concludes what I did yesterday, but which most of the media is intent on not pursuing. 7 months into the war, its resolution appears more distant than ever and its reverberations more dangerous. Perhaps not since the Cuban Missile Crisis 6 decades ago, have American and Russian leaders confronted each other so explicitly and sharply on the danger of nuclear war. Captain Jerry Hendricks writes in the National Review this morning, Putin approaches the nuclear red line, posted yesterday afternoon. Vladimir Putin's reach has exceeded his grasp, and he is panicking. Last night, again, this was written yesterday afternoon, in a major speech Tuesday night to the Russian people, Putin partially mobilized the Russian military for the first time since World War II. Additionally, he threatened to use nuclear weapons against Ukraine and the West in retaliation for a series of what he called bold-faced lies regarding aggressions against the Russian people. He closed his shocking statements with a warning that he was not bluffing. President Biden, according to Jerry Hendricks, has already partially responded to Putin's bluster. But Putin needs to be told in clear, unmistakable language that if he should choose to follow this path, it would trigger a full response from NATO and the introduction of Western aircraft, ships, and troops into the Ukrainian theater of operations. I agree with Jerry Hendricks, but we have not seen that from President Biden. We saw some words at the UN yesterday from him, but they did not come anywhere close to what you need to deter. I'll talk with Senator Joni Ernst, Congressman Michael Waltz and Mike Gallagher, all of them on the armed services of the Senate and House Committee, respectively. Gallagher also on Intel about what to do about Putin's threat. Other news. Fed, of course, raised interest rates 0.75 point for the third time in a row. And when they did that, that's the Wall Street Journal, the Financial Times. It triggered a run on the yen again. So Japan had to intervene to prop up the yen for the first time since the late 1990s. As the world's economies continue to shake under the Biden inflation, exacerbated by the invasion of Ukraine, but it is the Biden printing of trillions that has made the world ill. The 5 takeaways from President Biden's speech to the world, according to Politico, there are 5. And it's interesting that I didn't see any of these clips play last night. I didn't see anything about the president last night of significance, saying, among other things, regime change is a bad thing and that there's a lack of vision for hopelessly locked conflicts in Ethiopia, Venezuela, Haiti, Yemen. It was actually just a very rambling speech. Good news. Alexander Drucki and Andy Tai-Hyun are both from Alabama. They both went to fight the Russians in Ukraine and they've both been freed. That's good news. Hundreds of people are protesting and arrested in Russia as men flee in panic to avoid fighting in Ukraine. 300,000 reservists are going to be forced into the front lines of Ukraine, and young men are, mostly young men, are fleeing. The 50-minute flight to Minsk, Belarus, and it went up to 1,500 pounds in 1 day because people are trying to get the heck out of Russia. Iran's president, whatever reason, given a visa by the United States Department of State, even though Iran is actively trying to kill Americans on our soil, astonishing, castigated Israel, hailed Soleimani, holding up his picture. The Israelis, of course, walked out. He ought not to have been in the United States. Bank chiefs have warned China that if Taiwan is attacked, they will lose all their credit. I don't think that's really going to deter. I really don't. I don't think that's going to do a thing. Liz Truss, new prime minister of Great Britain, is ripping up green planning laws in a bid to kickstart house building. Good for you, Liz Truss. Liz Truss is lifting the fracking ban. Good for you, Liz Truss. Jacob Rees-Mogg, who is the business minister, has scrapped the ban on fracking, according to the Telegraph this morning, in Britain's countryside, amid a scramble to shore up domestic energy supplies. Good for Jacob Rees-Mogg. Donald Trump has been sued by the New York Attorney General in a civil proceeding alleging fraud. Now, I was talking with a good lawyer last night about this case, because I understand the Slate case, and I understand the documents case, and I've written an op-ed about it over at the landing page, urging people to remember. They don't know nothing. Nobody knows nothing about the facts of those cases other than the allegations made by DOJ. And they ought not to rush off and convict Donald Trump of conspiracy or espionage or whatever they want to convict Donald Trump of. It's just a, hey, wait a minute, people, op-ed at the Washington Post, which has got, I don't know, 3,500 columns because comments because the wackos and the blue bubble hate anything that reminds people that Donald Trump hasn't been indicted, much less convicted of anything. But this AG lawsuit in New York is a civil lawsuit. It really is astonishing because the victim is allegedly people who had otherwise borrowed money from Morgan Stanley. I can't figure it out. They've got no harm, allegedly, from Trump overstating his wealth. And by the way, they got lots of due diligence people at banks looking to see whether or not the lender is making a good choice in lending money. The former president went on Fox last night to talk about that. Cut 21.
The one good thing is people see what a great company I built. I built a great company, a powerful company, a company that's very lowly leveraged with among the best assets anywhere in the world. I mean, you look at this asset. She has this down to $75 million. I can tell you it's many times that number. She said, oh, he valued it at 75 or whatever it was, or she valued it at 75. What does Letitia James know? But if I were going, I don't have a mortgage on this property. If I was going to put a mortgage on this property, the institutions are going to be coming over. They're going to go through comparable properties all over Palm Beach or whatever it is, wherever it may be, Miami. We have them all over. We have tremendous properties. And again, we have very little debt. The debt we did have, it was paid current. The banks made a lot of money. She's trying to defend banks that got paid off. She's trying to defend banks that had unbelievable legal talent. I will tell you that. They're very good.
But it is kind of a crazy lawsuit. Bill Barr, former attorney general, went on Fox with John Roberts yesterday and commented this. Cut number two.
It's hard for me not to conclude it's a political hit job. And this is a woman who campaigned for office saying that, promising she was going to go after Trump, which I think is a tremendous abuse of office to go headhunting and targeting individuals. So I think she was targeting Trump. And this is after 3 years, a civil lawsuit, the gist of which is that when the Trump Organization borrowed money, Trump personally guaranteed those loans. And to support that, she's claiming that he inflated his assets on his financial statements. Now, I'm not even sure she has a good case against Trump himself, but what ultimately persuades me that this is a political hit job is she grossly overreaches when she tries to drag the children into this. Yes, they had roles in the business, but this was his personal financial statement. It was prepared by the CFO. Accounting firms were involved in it. The children aren't going to know the details of that and be able, and nor are they expected in the real world to do their own due diligence and have it, you know, reviewed independently.
I love Barr. He just lays it out. I also want to put Jerome Powell in there because the election in 48 days is going to be about this. Cut number three.
If we want to set ourselves up, really, really light the way to another period of a very strong labor market, we have got to get inflation behind us. I wish there were a painless way to do that. There isn't. So what we need to do is get rates up to the point where we're putting meaningful downward pressure on inflation. And that's what we're doing. And we certainly don't hope. We certainly haven't given up the idea that we can have a relatively modest increase in unemployment. Nonetheless, we need to complete this task.
September 22nd, Jerome Powell basically telling you the pain is here. Joe Biden has brought the pain, and the pain is going to stay for a long, long time in the American economy. The Biden economy. I'll be right back, America. Stay tuned. From number one New York Times bestselling author Vince Flynn comes Oath of Loyalty. Mitch Rapp confronts a very different kind of killer in the explosive new thriller in the bestselling Vince Flynn series, written by Kyle Mills. In the game of politics, some ties must be severed, but the Oath of Loyalty can never be broken. Oath of Loyalty by Vince Flynn, now available wherever books are sold. Go buy it today. I had a chance to interview the author, Kyle Mills, so go to my podcast to listen to that full interview. Oath of Loyalty by Vince Flynn. I'm Hugh Hewitt at Studio North. I'm joined by Iowa Senator Joni Ernst in the United States Senate, Congressman Michael Waltz from Florida. I always disclose my son works for the congressman. Welcome to you both, Senator and Congressman. I was going to talk to you first about Iran's sanctions, but I have to begin, and I'll begin with you, Senator Ernst, on Vladimir Putin's threat yesterday to use nuclear weapons. How should the United States respond to that?
Well, of course, Hugh, when you look at where Vladimir Putin is threatening the West, he always threatens, of course, where we are weak, and that's either on our energy policy or our nuclear policy. And so despite what Biden is doing, always retreating, what we need to do is make sure that we have a very strong commitment to rebuilding, expanding our nuclear capabilities, making sure that we have a strong U.S. Deterrent. So this is really important to us. We should unleash American energy, but then also make sure we've modernized and expand our nuclear capabilities.
Congressman Waltz, what should President Biden say, or did he say enough in his United Nations speech yesterday?
No, rhetoric matters here, Hugh. It matters tremendously. And what I would have liked to have heard from Biden is a very clear red line. There will be zero, absolutely no tolerance for any type of weapon of mass destruction, tactical nuke, chemical weapons, biological, zero, none, and it will be met with overwhelming response. It is the only way Putin is going to back down is he believes that his legitimacy, his regime would be in jeopardy if he does that. This is a time for strength to then lead us to deterrence so that Putin does not go there.
Front page or landing page of New York Times, Roger Cohen, Congressman Waltz, I'll stay with you for a second, suggests this is the most tense time since the Cuban Missile Crisis. I don't think the American media is treating it as such. Do you believe it is that level of tension?
You know, I don't know that it's that level of tension yet, Hugh, but I think it has the possibility to get there. I think two key red lines for Putin, and part of their doctrine, of Russian doctrine, is to escalate to tactical nuclear weapons as a means to de-escalate a situation, would be if Zelensky's offensive continues past the original line from their 2014 invasion, or if the Ukrainians are successful and able to press into Crimea. I think at that point, we would be in a very high-risk situation of Putin using some type of WMD, and that's why deterrence up front, strength up front, and making him understand that that would likely mean U.S. and NATO involvement is so critical right now.
Senator Ernst, you and Michael Waltz are both soldiers, and soldiers are in Poland, and if tactical nuclear weapons are used, they're going to get the drift. I mean, this is what's the red line you want to hear the president lay down, and what's the response you want him to outline?
Well, absolutely. We do have a number of American troops that are throughout Europe that could be exposed should Vladimir Putin do this, but that's where we do have to make sure we're pressing back firmly and making it extremely clear that Vladimir Putin should not be escalating to use nuclear weapons and that the West is prepared to respond. I always say America first, but never America alone. We have so many allies and partners, and this is where we can truly show strength as NATO is standing up to Vladimir Putin and saying, you affect us, you affect us all, we will respond. However, again, You do not want to escalate to that nuclear threat. I think we push back, but this is where we just need to show cohesiveness. We need to show strength and make sure that he doesn't go to that point.
Congressman Walz, let's turn to Iran. Yesterday, the president of Iran was invited to the U.N. I don't know why he got a visa. He came and he threatened Israel and America and held up a picture of the now dead Soleimani, who was in Iran, in Iraq, trying to kill Americans. What did you think about that? And what is the law that you proposed, law that you and the senator have introduced?
Well, on top of the supreme leader having visas, the sons of all of his inner circle are going to school in America. They're enjoying student visas. They're hanging out at Harvard and Princeton. So it's a broader issue of what we're allowing to come into this country and these thugs that we're allowing to come into the country and the rich elites in Iran. However, the bottom line of the legislation, I'm really proud to work with Senator Ernst on this, is twofold. One, we don't lift sanctions on countries that are holding Americans hostage, trying to assassinate American officials, John Bolton, Mike Pompeo, Robert O'Brien, and others, and, by the way, wounding and attacking American soldiers as they just did in Syria through its proxies. And then, two, we have to codify the sanctions on Iran, on its financial industry, its energy industry, its inner circle, because my fear, my biggest fear of these negotiations is that Biden somehow tries to tie the hand of a future administration, which is unconstitutional and wrong, by giving Iran through Russia some type of deal that if a future administration said this isn't in our best interest, would tie their hand.
Senator Ernst, I had a throat-choking moment last week when a Gold Star father called up about Iran. His son had been killed in Iran, in Iraq, by an Iranian-provided IED, those special IEDs that the IRGC provided. Why are we dealing with Iran, and would your legislation just shut down the Vienna talks immediately?
It would effectively shut down any work that we do with Iran. We don't know why the president continues down this path. It is a foolish, foolish idea to continue engaging with Iran when we know they didn't abide by the original JCPOA. They won't abide by this one. And we just saw a tweet as well yesterday or the day before from the Iranian foreign ministry that talked about the killing of General Qassem Soleimani, who was the person that orchestrated all of these IEDs that killed American soldiers. He did a lot of bad things to Americans. And so through this tweet, they're talking about General Soleimani and how Iran will now get back at the Americans that orchestrated the attack that killed Soleimani. So they're not only on American soil, but they're currently threatening while they're on American soil, threatening to kill Americans. And we shouldn't be engaging. God bless that Gold Star father, all of our wonderful Gold Star families that have given that ultimate sacrifice of a child, a spouse, a brother, a sister. You know, we've got to do better for them. And that means not engaging with the Iranians. We do need to shut them down. We need to shut their industries down and put that maximum pressure campaign back on them. We need to keep all of these sanctions in place and not allow President Biden to continue negotiating through this nuclear agreement, the lifting of those sanctions. General Steve Townsend, who is a former AFRICOM commander, he had stated that when the JCPOA went into place, when the United States released hold on all of this money that went to Iran, those dollars didn't go towards humanitarian support of the Iranian people. The regime spent that money on their terrorist proxies. And Congressman Walz always does an extremely good job at detailing all of these different violent extremist organizations, these proxies, as they are spread around the globe, and how Iran is influencing them, using those dollars to target Americans, to target allies and friends. We have to stop that.
Michael Walz, let's conclude by talking about in Iran today, unrest is spreading. The IRGC and the Quds Force out killing Iranians because of the murder of a woman arrested for an inappropriate hijab in the eyes of the religious police. Do you think President Biden will take a pass on speaking up for the Iranian people the way President Obama did during the Green Revolution, or will he speak up?
Well, he took a pass on speaking up for the Cuban people. He's taken a pass, you know, during their uprising. He's taken a pass of speaking up for the Venezuelan people. So I'm not holding my breath. We're seeing again and again the rest of our policy in the Middle East being held hostage for the administration's hope of entering this deal. And then we see the Iranians take advantage of it time and time again. As the senator mentioned, one of the key metrics that I watched under the Trump administration and why I knew the maximum pressure campaign was working was Iran couldn't pay its proxies. They couldn't pay Hezbollah. They were out of money to pay their militias in Iraq. They couldn't pay the Houthis. And if we release these sanctions, it is going to unleash billions coming out of Europe, coming out of South Korea, right into Tehran, right out to those terrorist proxies, and right into Moscow on a weapons buying spree, mainly for highly sophisticated air defensive systems that if we do ever have to go to a military option view, American and Israeli pilots are going to have to deal with, paid for by U.S. taxpayers.
Remarkable.
This bill would stop it.
I hope your bill gets traction immediately. Congressman Michael Waltz from Florida, Senator Joni Ernst from Iowa, thank you for joining me this morning. I hope your bill moves quickly, gets lots of co-sponsors on both sides of the aisle. Don't go anywhere, America. I'm Hugh Hewitt.
Hey, everyone. This is Duane Patterson, producer of The Hugh Hewitt Show. I've known for a while now that there's been far too much of me here in the studio, and I finally needed to do something about my weight. My excuse was always that I couldn't follow a plan with the crazy schedule that I keep. I heard about PhD Weight Loss and Nutrition and how they customize their program for each client, and I decided to call. This was no problem for Rachel and the PhD team. They had me map out what my day looks like and created a plan to follow. And so far, I've lost 16 pounds already and I'm just 2 weeks in on the way to my goal of losing 45. Call PhD Weight Loss and Nutrition at 864-644-1900 and make your appointment for your consultation. The plan is simple. It's based on science and nutrition. There's no pills or injections, and they even include 80% of your food if you want it. Call them right now at 864-644-1900 or find them online at myphdweightloss.com and tell them you heard about it from Duane, the producer Hugh actually has on The Hugh Hewitt Show.
I'm Hugh Hewitt. Congressman Mike Gallagher is on the House Intelligence Committee. Usually I banter with him a bit about sports, but I'm not going to do that today because we haven't had a threat for the use of nuclear weapons in my lifetime, and that happened this week. And I don't know that many people are paying attention, Congressman. You've got your PhD in national security, a Marine Corps intelligence officer. You're on the Intel Committee in the House and the Arms. Have you ever seen anything like this before?
Well, it certainly seems to have escalated tensions to a level we haven't seen since various periods throughout the Cold War. One's reminded of the Cuban Missile Crisis and other crises. And I think there's a tendency for analysts and casual observers to just dismiss Putin's statements as a bluff because we've kind of come to this point in America where we think the prospect of nuclear war is unthinkable, in contrast to the early days of the Cold War. But the more desperate Putin gets, I don't think we should discount the possibility that he could do something like this. Obviously, he's also mobilized 300,000 reservists in Russia, the first such mobilization since World War II. They're jailing dissenters, protesters in Russia. All the evidence suggests that he is not going to back down just because of the Ukrainian successes, recent successes on the ground, but indeed is going to double down and is hoping that as we enter a cold winter in Europe, that will give him more leverage perhaps to stop the slide of his position on the ground in Ukraine. So it's a very dangerous moment and we can't be intimidated by Vladimir Putin.
Well, that's what I want to go to, being intimidated. The New York Times put out by Roger Cohen the statement, this is the most dangerous moment since the Cuban Missile Crisis. Our friend Jerry Hendricks wrote a piece for National Review, we are approaching the red line. What do you want the president to say or threaten in response in order to deter Putin? Because yesterday's speech at the UN wasn't that.
Well, quickly, yesterday's speech at the new UN, I think, demonstrated the same geopolitical naivety that the president demonstrated a year before. Remember, in his first UN speech, Biden talked about, you know, we're ending the period of relentless war and ushering in a period of relentless diplomacy. And, you know, we no longer have to solve problems through military arms and we can do it through diplomacy. Well, what happened since then? Because of our commitment to reducing the role of hard power in American grand strategy. Well, Putin invaded Ukraine. The Chinese have gotten more belligerent over Taiwan. Iran has gotten closer to having a nuclear weapon. So the Biden administration's naive belief that soft power and statements coming out of Davos and COP26 can deter bad guys, dictators, and crazy terror-supporting regimes like that, which we see in Iran, is a bad strategy, and it is not working on the world stage. And so I was dismayed to see that the president doubled down on that at the UN. What can we do? Well, the obvious thing is to provide the Ukrainians with some of the longer-range weapon systems that they're asking for, such as the ATACMS. The administration is claiming, well, we don't want to give them weapons with ranges that could allow them to strike Russian targets. That's totally bogus, Hugh. We're already giving them weapons in certain areas that could strike Russian targets. More to the point, there are legitimate targets on Russian soil that just happen to be nearby Ukrainian territory that we shouldn't hesitate to allow the Ukrainians to attack. And it's not more one weapon system, in my opinion. An ATACM is not inherently more escalatory than, let's say, a HIMARS weapon system just because it has a longer range. So there's more we can be doing to provide them with weaponry, Hugh. But the reality is we've revealed how brittle our industrial base is with respect to our ability to produce certain munitions. We just don't make enough of these things, and we're going to have to ramp up, particularly as we try to deter a war over Taiwan.
Now, Congressman, the nightmare scenario, which is, I think, has to be considered specifically, is that a tactical nuclear weapon would be used by Russia in the interior of Ukraine in order to create a catastrophe that would paralyze the country. If Putin does that, and your colleague Michael Waltz and Joni Ernst were on earlier, and they said that would be classic Russian doctrine, escalate in order to de-escalate, and they have that doctrine where you ramp it way up so that you can get back down. What would we do in the immediate aftermath? Captain Hendrick says sink their Black Sea fleet, bomb their targets with NATO aircrafts in Ukraine. Conventional responses to a tactical nuke. What do you think Biden ought to say we will do?
Well, I think Jerry has it right. I mean, I think we should have been far more aggressive in terms of the naval aspect of this war from the start. We never should have sailed our ships out of the Black Sea from the start. But there's a variety of Russian targets around the globe that we could strike without actually using nuclear weapons ourselves. So I do think we would have to respond very aggressively. You can't allow even a tactical nuke to be used without a devastating response. Of course, we would want to be united in that response with our NATO allies. And though it would not be an attack against a NATO member, it would be a massive escalation in the conflict. And so we would want to make sure that we had the support of our NATO allies as well. But doing nothing certainly would not be an option. So let's rule out sort of the cool hand Luke approach, which is what I fear the Biden administration might choose. And remember, Hugh, I think it just comes back to this.
Expand on what is the cool hand Luke approach?
Well, in cool hand Luke, he says sometimes nothing can be a real cool hand. In this case, that doesn't work. Nothing, I think, is problematic. As I've said before on your show, the fear of provocation, which seems to dominate the Biden administration's decision making, is itself provocative in so much as it allows our enemies to think that they continue to make advances and they won't be met with a swift response. I just might add to Jerry's smart take on how we could strike conventionally. There's a lot more I think we could be doing in the cyber domain to really go after Russian infrastructure. Obviously, we have significant domestic vulnerabilities. It's what we've been talking about for 2 years on the cyberspace Solarium Commission. But there are ways in which we could impose real costs on Putin in the cyber domain. But let's dedicate ourselves to the idea of deterring Putin from using a nuclear weapon. And I think the stronger we are in terms of providing the Ukrainians with the conventional weapons that they need, it actually makes the threat of nuclear war less likely. We can't back down. I think weakness is provocative in this case.
Now, Congressman Waltz said, look, you know, it gets very dangerous if the Zelensky initiative to retake Crimea succeeds. If Putin's back is against the wall, and all of a sudden he's not only back against the wall, he's stuffed into a corner, and he's losing in a way that no one can imagine. I think a tactical nuclear weapon, about which I'm fundamentally ignorant, so I want to put that on the table, means tens of thousands of people dead, right? I think that's what it means. Is that not inevitable? And we would be so stunned. The world would be so stunned. It would be like after 9/11 when people just had no idea what to do. Do you want this is an open-ended question. Do we want President Biden to lay out the minimum that we would do in the aftermath of the use of a tactical nuclear weapon killing thousands, tens of thousands, or hundreds of thousands?
I've always believed that clarity in terms of how you climb up the escalation ladder is actually helpful. So at a minimum, I would like the president to send a strong signal that he would respond. He doesn't need to get into the precise operational or tactical details of we're going to strike this Russian target or this Russian warship. I get it, right? He might want to preserve some flexibility and perhaps some ambiguity would be useful, but at least sending the signal to Putin, sending the signal to our allies that this is unacceptable and would be met with a devastating response, I think would give us a chance of deterring the actual use of a nuclear weapon in the first place. As for the Ukrainians, increased confidence that they can eventually take back Crimea. Listen, I don't think we should do anything to undercut the momentum that the Ukrainians have right now. We don't know at what point either side is going to want to sue for peace or have a ceasefire. That's not for us to decide right now. We should just be supporting the continued Ukrainian advances on the ground and put them in the strongest position when they decide that they might want to force the Russians to negotiate on terms that are favorable to the Ukrainians. But right now, we shouldn't be inserting ourselves into the negotiating table proactively in a way that could undercut the momentum they have. And they're fighting very effectively and bravely on the ground right now.
At the leaders of NATO, and you're talking about Liz Truss and Macron and Scholz and Biden, they're the big four. Ought they to get together and, if not spell out what they would do, say that they have agreed on what would be done if a tactical nuclear weapon was used?
I think that'd be very, very helpful. But more than anything, I think the non-U.S. leaders of NATO need to make sure that they're delivering on many of the promises they've made in terms of weapon systems that they need to deliver to Ukraine. And that's not happened in full right now. We've had a lot of talk. We've had a lot of talk from the Germans in particular, but we still have a long way to go in terms of our European allies waking up, increasing their investment over the next decade in their own defenses, but in the short term, delivering certain weapon systems to Ukraine, as well as taking a look at NATO's entire force posture and reforming it so that we have more hard power on NATO's front lines. And we're taking advantage of some of the unique capabilities that our Baltic state allies in particular have. Again, I think if this isn't a wake-up call for NATO and for Europe more broadly, then I don't know what is.
My last question, Herman Kahn and others used to think about the unthinkable all the time and write about it. I'm a child of the Cold War, so we grew up that. Nobody does that anymore, do they? I mean, you're an intel guy and you're a reader of NASA. Does anyone talk about this anymore?
Well, there's still, we have great nuclear thinkers on our side in the next generation. Matt Kronig at Georgetown, an old professor of mine and friend, stands out. What's interesting, Hugh, is that I think because strategic theory, like nuclear theory, was so developed in the Cold War, our thinking on conventional escalation has actually atrophied. And then if you add into that, there's actually little thinking being done about escalation and deterrence in the financial and economic realm. And we confront this problem with China, right? How would a war with China play out, not only in terms of military on military, but what would we be willing to do in the financial and economic war? What are the weapons we would leverage there? And we're not integrating those thinkers in with sort of our hard power military theorists. And that's one thing that concerns me.
It's interesting you bring that up because there's an article in the Financial Times today about the world's bankers threatening China yesterday. U.S. bank chiefs warn of China exit if Taiwan is attacked. I would gather you think that's a very good warning from J.P. Morgan, Chase, Bank of America, and Citigroup.
Yes, but we need to take preemptive measures to slow the Chinese down. For example, any university endowment, particularly universities that receive federal government subsidies, should not be investing in China, particularly those who are lecturing us about ESG. Why invest in a genocidal, godless communist regime that has a million people enslaved in a modern day concentration camp? Call me crazy, but I think that would be a good idea.
Well, you are crazy. You're a Packers fan. Hope you're watching the Browns tonight beat the Steelers, Congressman. Good watching on Thursday night prime time. So I expect to hear from you next week about that. Congressman Mike Gallagher, a pleasure. Thank you.
Follow
him at Rep Mike Gallagher on Twitter. I want to remind you that our sponsor is AndrewandTodd.com. There with Sierra Pacific, they lend you money to refinance your house or buy a home or help your son or daughter become investors in real estate by becoming a non-occupying co-borrower. They help senior citizens with reverse mortgage. They help veterans with no money down mortgages. They help you refinance. So if you need to get money out of your house or you need a whole new house, go to andrewandtodd.com or call them at 888-1172. Welcome back, America. I'm Hugh Hewitt at Studio North, joined by the chairwoman of the Republican National Committee, Rhonda McDaniel. Good morning, Madam Chairwoman. Great to have you back.
Good morning. Always good to be with you, Hugh.
Thank you, Ron. I want to begin with item number 18 in news items by John Ellis this morning. It's a summary of a Politico article. It reads, Democrats have been on a voter registration tear since the Supreme Court overturned Roe v. Wade. There's just one problem for them. They are digging out from a major Republican gains in the last 18 months. For most of the 2 years leading up to the midterm election, Republicans rather than Democrats were making voting registration gains in key state. A Politico analysis of state voter data shows a signal of GOP momentum heading into a classic backlash election against Democratic control of Washington, D.C. Rana, if our registration is up, that's on you. Congratulations.
Thank you. We've definitely been working on that. It's our team. The RNC stayed on the ground after 2020 and made this a priority. So in states like Pennsylvania, North Carolina, Florida, you have seen us outpace the Democrats in voter registration, which is going to be key heading into this election.
There was an attempt in the summer after the Dobbs decision by legacy media to say Democrats had momentum because the president forgave student loans, fueling inflation, passed a big CHIPS Act with Republican help, but then also spent another $700 billion in the reconciliation. And then, Dot, I don't think they've got momentum, Chairwoman McDaniel. What do you think?
I agree with you. I actually think the student loan forgiveness decision by Democrats backfired on them on top of the Death Star speech that Biden gave, calling 74 million Republicans pretty much awful people and semi-fascists. And we have seen a tightening in all the polls in the Senate races, and we feel momentum heading into November.
I'm feeling bad for the president. He was lost on his stage again yesterday, Chairwoman McDaniel. So I'm kind of feeling the red setting, red wedding speech was a nightmare. I haven't heard it called the Death Star speech before. I like that as well. Let's start with the Senate, then move to the House, then move to the governorships. Ronna McDaniel, Republicans have to hold Wisconsin, Pennsylvania, Ohio, and North Carolina. I think Wisconsin, Ohio, and North Carolina are locked up tight. I think PA is 50-50. What's your assessment?
I would agree. I think Ron Johnson's in a tough race in Wisconsin. They're going to spend a lot of money there, too. But the polling has been showing him ahead. JD's been very strong in Ohio, North Carolina. Ted Budd's been doing well. And that's a state where we've had big voter registration gains, and we did very well in 2020 across the board. So I agree. I think Pennsylvania's 50-50. Oz is closing, though, and it's peaking at the right time in some of these states. And I think he's doing the right thing, hitting Fetterman on crime. And that is really the issue that's moving the needle in Pennsylvania right now.
Okay, tough question that people split on. Who is more radical, Mandela Barnes in Wisconsin or John Fetterman in Pennsylvania?
Oh, I think it's a tie. A tie for radical, pro-criminal, crazy socialist policies. I mean, they've been terrible. Yeah. But it's frightening when you look at the type of prisoners that they have been part of releasing or called for being released. It is really, really radical what they're willing to do to their states. And I think as the voters get a look at them and what their policies are and their records, it's waking them up and bringing them to the Republicans.
Now, voting begins in Minnesota tomorrow, Chairwoman McDaniel. I had Tom Weiler on yesterday. He's running in the 3rd Congressional District. Great candidate. I've been having all these would-be freshman Republicans on. Great candidates. What do we do in a place like Minnesota when early voting starts? I mean, it's going to be September 23rd tomorrow. What do you do?
Yeah, I mean, we have an election integrity person on the or a data person on the ground in Minnesota. We have some staff. We're more congressionally focused in Minnesota. We also have to keep the Hagedorn seat, which unfortunately he passed away earlier this year. So we just get our poll watchers, which we've been training, and make sure that we have a good operation to watch not just election day, but also the counting before election day in a lot of these absentee ballot voting areas.
All right, let's go back to the Senate. There are three that I count as likeliest pickups. I think Herschel's going to win in Georgia. I feel so confident about that because he's the nicest guy in Georgia. I think Adam Laxalt's going to win in Nevada. They've had it with the invisible senator. But I also think in the top three is a surprise. Joe O'Day is going to win in Colorado. Those are my top three pickups. Do you agree or disagree?
I agree. I like them all three. I still put Blake Masters in there. I think Blake is doing a good job in surging and really hitting the issues hard. And the more he exposes Mark Kelly as being the one vote that could have stopped the Biden administration, knowing what's happening in Arizona on the border and his refusal to do that, I think it really hits home. And then I still have hope for Don Bolduc in New Hampshire. So I'm with you. And Tiffany Smiley, I was on a plane with her yesterday in Washington. She's just amazing.
That's my second tier. And I actually have three tiers because I put Blake Masters. My most confidence are in Georgia, Nevada, and Colorado. Then I have Blake, who is on an hour number one. Then I have Washington and New Hampshire. So let's talk about Arizona. Do you remember, Ronna, you weren't the chairwoman yet. It might have been during the benighted reign of Michael Steele, but Ed Gillespie almost beat Mark Warner, and the poll said he was 9 points yeah. down in 2014. That's what I tell everyone. You just can't believe these polls. They're always wrong.
You can't. And we actually showed this a couple weeks ago, Hugh, to a lot of our investors, which is there's a pattern. It goes all the way to 2014, like you said. But even in 2020, there was not a single poll that had Susan Collins winning. Tom Tillis was behind in North Carolina. And part of this is to suppress support for Republican candidates, I think from the big donors, actually, and then to ramp up support for Democrats. And it has been wrong. If the media, the legacy media was correct, then we would have lost 15 House seats in 2020 instead of picking up 15 House seats. They're just wrong. So I think everybody needs to get out, work as hard for these candidates. Momentum's on our side. And I think if you look at the polls, they always underrepresent Republican voters. That's what I think is consistent.
Now, I work for the Washington Post, so I hate to say this, but I always bring it up. ABC News, Washington Post poll of Wisconsin the week before the 2020 presidential election said Joe Biden had a 17-point lead. Joe Biden won by 0.6% in Wisconsin. I go back to the Mark Warner, Ed Gillespie. I go back to the Matt Bevin. There are incredible misses. And I think if there's one place they're going to miss, it's Arizona. And I think they could miss big in Arizona, Ronna.
I do, too. Listen, Carrie Lake is running a strong lake.
Yes.
A strong race at the top of the ticket for governor. I think she's going to win. I think Blake, I spent a lot of time with Blake on my podcast. I'm actually releasing my podcast with him today on Real America. And I love him. I think he's a great candidate. He will be a value add in the Senate with his tech experience and understanding what Google and Facebook and others are doing. But we also have a lot of competitive House races in Arizona.
Yes.
And that gets under... overlooked. You know, look at Juan Siskamani. He's going to win that seat. We're going to
put some House
seats, which
in
is going to drive turnout for the top of the ticket too.
Juan Siskamani is a superstar in Tucson, and he's been on a couple of times. Let me go then to the House. So we got the Senate laid out. I'm feeling very good about Leader McConnell returning as Leader McConnell. I think the over-under for the House is 25. That is where, if I was Las Vegas and setting the odds, I think the GOP may pick up more than 25. They might not pick up as many 25. Are you an over and the under on that, Ronna McDaniel?
You know, I never like setting a number in the sand, but I think that's a good number. I think that's a fair number. Listen, when people were saying 50, 60, I thought it was outrageous because we're already starting at 214. We need five to take back the House, right? So you look at the Obama, you know, when we won 63, we were starting at 178. Comparing those two is just not fair when we picked up 15 last cycle. The red wave started then when we picked up 15 in 2020. So I think 20 to 25 is a really good night. For me, winning back the House, five is a great night retiring Nancy Pelosi. We just have to make sure we fight the Democrats everywhere. They want to hold on to power. They will do anything to keep it. And we want to make this election about helping the American people. This is an American people first election for the Republican Party.
When I talked to former President Trump last week, I said the Republicans want to talk about inflation, crime and the border. They want to talk about education in China. Democrats want to talk about abortion and you, Mr. President. And we talked about that. But I want to ask you, in terms of education, I've encouraged this audience not to vote for one school board member who they are not absolutely certain opposes mandatory masking and shutdowns of school. If they have any doubt at all, don't vote for them. Is education the Republicans' secret weapon in this election?
Totally. The amount of people running for school board for the first time, the moms that have been so enraged by what happened to their kids, and dads too, that are getting out there, just like we saw in Virginia, there's an undercurrent of that across the country. I run into it everywhere I go. I know that I'm doing the same thing. I'm researching all the signs in my community. I know I'm not voting for a single incumbent school board member. I don't care who they are. I don't care if they're one of them's my next door neighbor. I won't vote for them because what they did to my kids. And no more lockdowns, no more mandates.
And I want to close by state legislatures. This is the hidden metric. You had big wins, the RNC did, in the 2020 cycle with state legislatures. It saved redistricting from being a complete Illinois and Massachusetts jam down, gerrymander. So we got a couple of states gerrymandered for us, and that's good. It's the way the system's supposed to work. What do you think about state legislative houses in the aftermath of redistricting? It's very hard for me to get visibility into that, Chairwoman.
Yeah, you know, it's going to be state by state, and turnout will be a factor. And I think, you know, as good as the bottom of the ticket does, as well as the top of the ticket does, that's going to determine these state legislative races. You know, I think Michigan, for example, is going to have an interesting election because you're going to have abortion on the ballot. So that's going to change the complexion of the race. But I feel good. I think we're going to pick up more seats. But, you know, I can't. We're more focused on federal Senate and House at the RNC. So that's where my eyes are right now.
Let's close by talking about redwin.com, one of your inventions during your tenure of RNC, along with Kevin McCarthy and Leader McConnell. How's it working? WinRed.
WinRed is, yeah, it's doing great. I mean, listen, Hugh, when I was chair in 2018, the Democrats raised $300 million more than our candidates on Act Blue just on the House side. And they were able to spend 6-7-1 against all of our candidates, which was part of the reason we lost the House. With WinRed, we now have a small dollar fundraising operation for our candidates, and it's allowing them to get their message on TV. We need people to keep donating, give to every single Senate candidate, give to these House candidates. It is the best way for them to get their message out and fight the Democrats. The Democrats have Act Blue. It's been around for 20 years, so it's way ahead of us. We needed this desperately, and I think it's doing a good job.
It's doing a great job. WinRed.com. If you don't know who to support, WinRed.com will send your money to the right place.
Yeah, just give generally. Click on your state. You can just give to the RNC. We're out there supporting the candidates. And it is critical that we have, I know we win if we have the resources. That's the biggest issue. They're going to have more resources because they've got Soros and Zuckerberg and Bloomberg. We don't have those big guys. We need to be funded by our small dollar, and our American support will help us.
Ronna McDaniel, always a pleasure. Keep coming back. Voting begins tomorrow, so the election is underway. And if the Republicans do well, it'll be because of that lady, Ronna McDaniel. Thank you, Chairwoman.
3-star general Michael J. Flynn, head of the Pentagon Intelligence Agency, knew all the government's dirty secrets.
He was one of the most respected generals in the military.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to. He understood its funding.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
The explosive new documentary, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, and covers the facts behind this scandal.
Flynn told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire.
I find out the worst enemy that I'm going to face in my life is right here in America. They took my assessment and they wanted me to change it. And I was like, I'm not changing it.
They had to get rid of Flynn.
With in-depth interviews, archival footage, and never before seen personal records of the man behind the headlines.
I just felt like I was drowning.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to salemnow.com. Salemnow.com.